Okay, so let's begin. Today we're going to deal with Emily Dickinson. I've been trying for a couple of weeks to hold the microphone in a different way because one of your classmates, Jerusalem, told me that the sound quality was not very good. We've just recorded a different class about Longfellow, and I was moving around, and apparently this doesn't work so well if I'm moving around, so in an attempt to make things a bit better, I'm going to stay put, and let's see if the sound quality is more acceptable today than in other occasions for those of you that watch it recorded. We've reached Unit 20 of the book. That means that we're already two-thirds past in the second semester. And the second semester goes by so fast because we come back after the February break, and there's normally many weeks in a row, and we get a lot of material covered. And I think it's at the same time exciting and scary because we've covered a lot of material, but at the same time it's a lot to take in, and I'm not very sure if this speed of advancement is the most appropriate for students like you that normally have a job and a life and don't devote all your time to studying English. But we have to move forward. In the case of Emily Dickinson, we're going to see a very, very, very important author. I think it's probably one of the authors that leaves the deepest amount of resonance in modern times. And it shouldn't be like that, because her express wish was for all of her possessions to be burned after she died. When she died, in the silence and in the intimacy of her house, from where she practically did not move during her entire lifetime, her sister Lavinia was given the task of compiling all her personal elements and, following the express wishes of Emily Dickinson, burned them. The thing is that they weren't expecting to find what they found. What they found was an incredible array of letters, versions of poems, and tons and tons and tons of pages. Not literally tons, but you get the idea. An immense amount of pages full of poems that had never been read by anybody. So within this intimacy, the first thing that stands out with Emily Dickinson is that she was absolutely free. She was absolutely free to be as experimental as she wanted. And she wanted to be very experimental. So she experimented with everything. She experimented with the length of the lines, with the punctuation, with the rhyme, eliminating it, with the length of the poem, even with the grammar. If the grammar didn't suit her, why couldn't she change grammar? The poem was for her. She didn't have the constraints that other poets had. Example, in the case of Longfellow that we've seen before, of having to please an audience. She had to please herself. She had to like her poems. She went basically unpublished for her entire life. The poems that she published were very limited. And normally, referring to her first poem was published on Valentine's Day of the year when she turned 19, and that poem is a poem of a teenager. But in that poem, she connects the idea of marriage and death, and those ideas of human relationships, a natural approach to death and life and inner experience, that's Emily Dickinson. Those three or four concepts, the inner world of Emily Dickinson is Emily Dickinson. She does not receive a great deal of influence from the outer world. In fact, there is the belief that she never read Walt Whitman, which was contemporary with her. Just because somebody had told her that Walt Whitman was a scandalous writer, and she didn't want to read scandalous writers. So she was absolutely against reading Walt Whitman, and she probably never was exposed to Walt Whitman and couldn't evaluate whether Walt Whitman could provide some type of influence to Emily Dickinson. So here we have these two giants of poetry that practically went unheralded during their entire life. Walt Whitman received fame at the end of his life and was considered a scandalous and immoral person during the majority of her lifetime. And Emily Dickinson, who nobody knew besides a very close circle of people, among which were one of her potential editors, that didn't do too much to have the poetry published. And the whole situation is a bit reminiscent to Anne Bradstreet, but on a much higher scale. In the case of Anne Bradstreet, you might remember that Anne Bradstreet's brother-in-law took the poems without her consent and published them. And once they were out in the public and in the world, she sort of liked it, and she embraced that her publishing, and she created a preface, and she re-adorned those poems, extended, created new versions of those poems. So Anne Bradstreet is the figure of the Emily Dickinson that could have been, but that we will never know if that would be the best outcome for Emily Dickinson's poetry. Because if anything, Emily Dickinson is absolutely raw in terms of untouched by influences of editors that would have changed, or other authors that would have changed her style of writing. Her creative genius is there, and it's as intact as can be. One of the problems that Emily Dickinson had was that every time that she did publish, normally her poems were published anonymously, of course, a few, maybe half a dozen of her poems saw the light during her lifetime. Her poems were modified. They would regularize the rhyme that she had avoided. They would change the words inside her poems. They would change the punctuation. I want you to pay attention to her use of capitalization, the capital letters. And Emily Dickinson is very easy to like because normally she's very easy to read, very easy to create an appreciation towards her poetry, because it does seem to be a poetry for everyone. That aspiration that Walt Whitman had, and that he strived so much in looking for technical perfection and technical modification, to Emily Dickinson, it seems to have come in a natural manner, but in a different way. For every poem that we see in Walt Whitman being expansive and outreaching to the world, Emily Dickinson's were intimate and addressed to her, or to her inner circle, to a reduced group of people. She seemed to have no interest in the world, and the world had no knowledge of her. So this type of contradictory situation that we have with one of the most genial authors is what brings us to this moment. And I think this is a verse from Emily Dickinson. It's a very good way of starting. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me. She passed through life unacknowledged by everyone, despite her genius. Let me first read about the influences. And the last day I couldn't find in this from Puritanism to Postmodernism, the part that was about Melville. This period is really interesting because it is coincidental for Melville and for Whitman and for Dickinson, we saw that Whitman had an appreciation for Emerson, and we know for a fact that that Dickinson was exposed to the writings of the time, except those that she decided not to read because she found them scandalous. So we can come to the conclusion that Emerson, again, is that lurking figure that is not directly responsible for any work of genius, but is so influential for other works of other people. And probably the same type of addresses that Emerson did of what a poet should be would reach Dickinson. Let me read from here where it connects the works of both authors. I think it's on, yes. On page 172 of this book, From Puritanism to Postmodernism, it is part of the extended bibliography, the authors say, "The proof of a poet is that his country absorbs him as affectionately as he has absorbed it." Whitman wrote in the early confident days of his 1855 preface, only to find out how long it would take before reciprocal absorption would indeed begin to develop. It is one of the ironies of American literature that the later 19th century should produce two major poets who would prove to be the genuine antecedents of the most serious modern American poetry. Yet that of those two, one should be a public poet who virtually lost the public he so confidently addressed, while the other was so private that scarcely any of her poems appeared in her own lifetime. Emily Dickinson so shunned public disclosure that most of her verses imply a total inwardness, a refusal to share in the collective utterance of the world. There is no ideal of chanting or talking here, rather a universal or rugged inward meditation and drama that takes on expression, but no clear social form. Indeed, to set Whitman and Dickinson side by side seems almost a breach of propriety. Though one way of understanding modern American poetry is to say that many of its poets did just that. So even though Dickinson and Whitman cannot be more contradictory, they are so coincidental that it's impossible not to put them side by side. In fact, I have a slide here where I compare and I contrast Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman. In fact, I have to contrast them much more than I have to compare them. What things do we want to achieve in this unit or in this lecture? We want to understand, and in this case it's coincidental with Walt Whitman, the slow reception that her poetry received, and compare and contrast it to Walt Whitman, both considered the peak of 19th century poetry, thanks to their experimentation, and the obvious stepping stone for the very, very influential modernist American poet. We're going to assess how Dickinson led a creative life in virtual isolation. Let me read from this, what I was saying before. The reception of her work. In the last chapter of this introduction, it talks about how her work was even discovered. "The poems and letters of Emily Dickinson that survive today are the result of relatives who saved her work, editors who published it, critics who studied it, and generations of readers who continue to celebrate it. In fact, the history of how Dickinson's work were published and received is just as exciting, mysterious, and controversial as the poems themselves. To understand the poems today, it is useful to begin with the print history of her work and Dickinson's own reservations about publication." So, for the public to be able to celebrate Dickinson, they have to go against her expressed wishes of not being either published or read, which is a contradiction in itself. After Emily Dickinson's death, Lavinia Dickinson inherited the painful task of sorting through her sister's possessions and cleaning out the room that had enclosed her for many years. Dickinson asked for her to be destroyed after her death, so Lavinia dutifully collected papers in preparation for burning. However, as she opened desk drawers and boxes, Lavinia stumbled across a cache of over 1,700 poems, an astonishing collection that no one knew existed. Despite her sister's wishes, Lavinia knew the poems were too precious and important to consign to fire. She saved the poems, making a vow to have them published. Without Lavinia's dedication to her sister's poetry, the life's work of one of America's most important poets would have vanished. However, through publication, Dickinson's private poems and letters were exposed to public scrutiny and judgment for appreciation and also for censure. You have to take into consideration that she had an odd life for the time. She was not considered normal or healthy, and we know how centuries are, for a woman to remain unmarried at home and to be so closely attached to her brother's wife, which has led to all types of theories about what was the nature of that relationship, which she many times set on a sisterly dimension. But it doesn't seem that it shouldn't be noticed that the biggest amount of correspondence was with her sister-in-law that happened to live next door. The manuscripts that survive today are difficult to label. Dickinson excelled at creating chimera, papers that have the look of letters, but the sound and rhythm of poems. Poems that read as straightforward as correspondence. Her letters often utilized alliteration, assonance, and rhyme, even when written as mere newsletters and thank you notes. Sometimes the poems in the fascicles appear in the form of letters sent to different people, each with slight variation. Dickinson clearly liked to blur the boundaries and saw no reason to compartmentalize her writing. The fact that she wrote letters to Sue that were small enough to fit in a dress pocket probably means that she kept her draft close to her body, working and reworking them throughout the day. It's very curious to think of the concept that she lived next door to her sister-in-law, Susan, that she chose to communicate with her in letters, which is quite curious. She chose to use that form of communication with everyone around her, but especially with Susan. The difficulty in classifying her manuscripts is only one of the factors that has affected Dickinson's publication. Perhaps for Dickinson, more than for any other American poet, the issue of publication is thickly interwoven with discussions of biography, history, aesthetics, and interpretation. What constitutes a poem? When can a letter be called a poem, or a poem be called a letter? How are different types of writing defined? How important are characteristics of handwriting or stray pencil marks? These are some of the many questions editors and readers of Dickinson's poetry must answer. Only a few of Dickinson's poems were published during her lifetime, and there is much debate over whether Dickinson chose to submit and publish even those poems, or whether they were surreptitiously published by friends and fans. Regardless of how the poems ended up in the hands of editors, each subsequent editor, challenged by Dickinson's unusual and rebellious verse, altered the poems in some fashion to make the work more appealing to their own taste and to the public expectation. So in the case of Dickinson, we're going to have punctuation marks that we're not used to seeing, hyphens, guiones, capital letters, out of place, with no modifications of grammar, varying length of line, different positions of the line. So even what I'm doing in this PowerPoint presentation, I should probably print out a picture of Emily Dickinson's handwritten poem to be faithful to what Dickinson wanted read. And every time you read a Dickinson poem, you're probably going to read something that has been, intentionally or not, modified to a certain extent, and that differs with the author's original poem. So probably to be able to enjoy Dickinson in the full exactitude, you would have to go with the handwritten poems and read them as they are, with all the marks and all the peculiarities that they have. In the case of Dickinson, we're going to apply strategies of close analysis, which you know that to a certain measure were introduced by Edgar Allan Poe, and that were very much used in literary theory of the second half of the 20th century by the post-structuralists, by the structuralists, by all of these schools of thought that came in the second half of the 20th century. We're going to pay attention to items that might seem casual, like different types of spelling, capitalization, punctuation, and lineation. We're going to see how Dickinson has a special talent for indirection, for having poems that do not seem to have an established goal or purpose, and the linguistic economy, how compressed they are. We're going to focus on Dickinson's unusual and unique originality that stemmed from her capacity to visualize ideas, but also to evoke other type of imagery, such as oral imagery or factory imagery. In the case of Dickinson, we're going to really have to use our five senses to be able to appreciate her poetry. She was born in Massachusetts in a Unitarian community. Remember that Unitarians are very far in terms of thought. With the Puritans and their religious dispute is quite significant. We're not going to go into religious details, but Unitarians coexisted with other religious communities in the United States. We've already talked. We basically focused on Puritanism when it was relevant for literature. In the case of most authors, when we talk about their biography, we mention their religious upbringing, but it's not especially significant in the case of Emily Dickinson. She spent her lifetime within Homestead, a family mansion. She led a life of practically voluntary imprisonment. She was a recluse by temperament and habit. She lived most of her life at home. She tried to go to the school, but she failed and went back home. Her way of interacting with the outside world was through her poetry and correspondence with a very limited set of people, among which the most important person was her sister-in-law, Susan. She attended a female seminary for only two semesters and decided to return home. There is very little known about her life that it has not been extracted as conclusions from her correspondence with other members of her life, other members of her family and her relatives and closer relations. Many of the facts that have been come to, that many have concluded about Emily Dickinson are based on fabricated conclusions. As is the case with Edgar Allan Poe, it's very difficult to distinguish what is fact and what is a fictionalized or a theorized account of what happened during their lifetime in the case of Dickinson. Very little can be said because there is very little written record about these daily activities of their lives and whereabouts at certain moments of their lives. Both Dickinson and Edgar Allan Poe, unless something spectacularly unexpected happens, it will just never be known. And we will always theorize about elements of their lifetime. And while we do have a lot of bibliographical knowledge about many of the other authors of the time, we know very little of the lives of, for example, Emily Dickinson and Edgar Allan Poe, and that they share that sort of aura of mystery and legend in their biographies. One of the biggest doubts that surrounds the work is that why she chose to remain unprinted in her lifetime, and did something that we've also seen in the case of Jane Austen. For most of her life, or Anne Bradstreet, we had the example of Anne Bradstreet. She desired a private circulation of her work, sometimes because she wasn't confident enough about the quality of her work, or because she thought that they were too intimate to be published for the general public out of a sense of shame, maybe. It remains unknown the real reasons behind that stance in her life. I think in that same reception, there is a... There is a section where she... Where this book talks about some of the reasons, sometimes when she was provoked to publish, or she was asked to publish, in 1862, the 31-year-old Dickinson wrote a letter to her literary mentor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson. We'll talk about Higginson in the presentation. Regarding publication, although Higginson clearly had Dickinson's eventual publication in mind, she writes, "I smile when you suggest that I delay to publish, that being foreign to my thought as firmament to Finn," for she thought that nothing was less possible than seeing her work published. She was absolutely convinced that she would go and publish, because it was either her biggest fear to be published, or it was something that she did not think that she was worthy of being published. So that has led many people to believe that most of the poems that were published during her lifetime were probably published by members of her family without her consent or without her direct involvement. Because it seems very strange that having such a serious amount of poems, only a few poems reached a published form during her lifetime. Her sister Lavinia initially found 900 poems the week after her death, and realized that there was a whole life of Emily that had gone unnoticed in its majority to the family, and she requested her sister-in-law's help. A first volume, very heavily amended, was published by Higginson and an enemy of Susan in 1890. So this person, Higginson, that Emily Dickinson had been exchanging poems during her lifetime, and that had the publication of Emily Dickinson's work in mind, colluded or worked together with someone that was that had a very bad relationship with Susan, with Emily Dickinson's sister-in-law. So this situation created a breach in Emily Dickinson's estate, on Emily Dickinson's legacy. So even if Lavinia hadn't published, hadn't retained those poems, some poems would have seen the light, but they would have probably been very seriously amended and modified. And that's very important to notice that she had those two different camps after her death that had contradictory views of how Dickinson's poems have to be published. From the literary point of view, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, the literary editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine, a magazine that is so recognized that it is still published, it is still one of the most influential American publications. It's a publication as prestigious as, for example, The New Yorker, the Atlantic Monthly, was in the mix when Emily Dickinson was still alive. She has gone from being literally unknown during her lifetime, except to her family members and few other people, such as Mr. Higginson, to achieving the highest position of literary fame, not only for American literature, but I would say for universal literature. It's very hard to encounter someone that is a connoisseur of poetry that doesn't admire Emily Dickinson's work. There is very, I cannot remember a single time when somebody told me, I've read Emily Dickinson and I don't get her. I don't like her poems at all. And I reject that type of poetry. It doesn't satisfy my literary taste. She seems to have some type of universal chord that seems to appeal to everyone. This type of Beethoven type of artistic creativity that is universally appealing. The same way that some people may or may not like Walt Whitman, some people may or may not like, I don't know, Nathaniel Hawthorne. Sometimes I get comments from students saying, I know that you talk very highly about Hawthorne. I fall asleep when I read him because he's very dark. It's not my cup of tea. On the contrary, when I read Mark Twain, I love him. Or I hear the opposite from some students. I think there's general consensus about Dickinson. It's very hard to find someone that doesn't love Dickinson's poetry and doesn't find it very witty, very fresh, very innovative, just by enjoying it without having to go into the technicalities of the poetry and the literary quality as beneath the initial reception. The first person in her poetry is not herself. There is a literary persona that can be a type of poetic eye, a literary eye. So don't take into consideration when you read her first person poetry as if she's writing about her own experience, because sometimes there is a poem that starts, I heard a buzz fly when I died. What does she do? She's imagining what happens when you're dying little by little and what type of things are capturing your attention in those last moments of your life. And it's sad to think about the fact that the last thing that you're going to recall before you pass away are a fly buzzing around you and bothering you in the middle of summer. But that seems to be very faithful to reality, and it takes this unheroic stance that is so contradictory or so counterposed to, for example, Whitman's heroicity in the normality. And I think that this is a point where we can again draw together Dickinson and Walt Whitman, no matter how difficult this task is. They deal with normality, but they deal with normality in a different way. Walt Whitman tends to connect normality to universality, to a universal heroic epic, whereas Dickinson just sees normality, and she sees this the combination of inner world and experiential type of view of things. It's an opposed view, but at the same time, they're dealing with the same topic of things. this slide. I've already got this slide. Her corpus is currently composed of 1,789 poems, which have become gradually available over the span of 100 years, from the initial publication after her death to the last edited versions. The last versions tend to be more faithful with the original version, so if you ever get an updated copy of Emily Dickinson's work, you'll probably be able to appreciate it's the same style of punctuation, capitalization, and particular traits that her poetry traditionally has. Her period of greatest productivity happens over a short period of time, only 6 years, where she composed over 1,000 poems. If you think of the ratio of poems per day, that returns it's an incredible amount of poetry written for a single person. There are more than 300 poems written only in the course of 1863, which means that she has like a daily poem to produce. Some of them are part of the poems that are more celebrated and more recognizable of her work. So this period that goes from 1859 to 1865, outside there's a civil war raging on and she's at the thing in her world that can never be more literal than in this case, just composing and reinterpreting the world through her poetry. Until the 1920s, there isn't a definite reevaluation of her work, and she becomes a fully rediscovered author and fully appreciated. From the 1920s forward, she gains this literary standard or status of a poetic giant in American literature. The style of Emily Dickinson are metaphysical distillation of situation, and they don't always refer to herself. Thus, the detachment of that poetic eye with her own persona. Her secluded life led her to create a tiny cosmos of individual experience and individual poetry. She is a poet of wit, which means witty ideas. Some poems are reflections of death. Some are transcendental looks on nature. Or she can appeal to nature as how eternal and infinite it is compared to the mortality and to the minuteness of the human being. And in that sense, again, we bring together some of the ideas that Whitman and Dickinson would have probably shared if they had also shared a cup of tea during one evening. They would probably have agreed on more things that they disagreed. Her legacy never seemed to have an echo on Romanticism. She seems to be completely detached by Romanticism. She seems to be a precursor of what modernism is going to bring. If you have to bring a degree of comparison, you can probably find more comparison with Emily Dickinson in the work of T.S. Eliot than if you look at the work of Edgar Allan Poe, for example. So she is much more a precursor of modernism than an echo chamber of Romanticism or romantic aesthetics. Her works defy this authoritative interpretation because they're very personal. She doesn't seem to have a feeling of wanting to portray a universal truth because she questioned any form of authority. She just seems to be sharing her interpretation of things without wanting to sound authoritative. We do see that aspiration in Whitman, for example. He wants to create a poetry that seems universal, that seems for everyone. We don't see that trend or that tendency in Emily Dickinson. She doesn't want the found authoritative, and she questions everything. The style is a style. I think that this is a very good area. Her poems live between doubt and certainty. There is that middle space is where her poetry floats, and she doesn't seem to provide answers. She, if anything, she provides more questions. So she's not here as a soothing poet. She might be a poet to make you think even more on the questions of life. Contrary to straightforwardness, she prefers the indirection of not carrying her message to any specific goal or to any specific place, which is quite contradictory with other authors of the kind that have a goal or a purpose. For example, when we read the poetry of Anne Bradstreet or Phyllis Wheatley, there's an agenda, there's a purpose in their poetry. In the case of Anne Bradstreet, it's to put forward the didactic purpose of Puritan culture, of God above everything as an explanation. In the case of Phyllis Wheatley, it's to subversively introduce the message of racial inequality within a very religious rapping, sometimes in a heroic tone, sometimes in a more everyday tone, but always with those two elements in her agenda, embracing religion and with the subversive racial message embedded in her poetry. In the case of Emily Dickinson, it seems to be like flashes of inspiration that come. She feels compelled to write about those ideas without any other purpose than maybe to share a letter with Susan and ask for her opinion on her thought. Her style is compact, brief, sharp, and compressed. Those four words are perfect to describe any one of Emily Dickinson's poems. Compact, brief, sharp, compressed. There's an economy in language. The themes normally revolve around life, death, and immortality. The elements that she used, the stylistic features that she used, are sometimes she recurs to rhyme, but she doesn't feel it needed to rely on rhyme, neither consonant nor assonant rhyme. She has a heavy tendency to be alliterative, to use a simile. We know that the simile is in the same range as a metaphor. The simile is more direct and more blunt. And the metaphor is more indirect. And sometimes there is analogy in the works. Let's compare Dickinson and Whitman. From the point of view of Dickinson, from the point of view of audience, Whitman is poetry for everyone. She wants to be the poet of America, and Dickinson wants to be the poet of her family. So, from that point of view, she can only appeal to a very elite upper class that understands and maybe shares her worries in a world that is full of strife and drama and real problems compared to these more metaphysical, more detached problems. Whitman has a public concern. Dickinson has a private view of life. Whitman is extremely extroverted. He writes for himself, but he writes for everyone. Dickinson is extremely introverted. You could say the problem shy and inhibited. Whitman is so exhibitionist that he even talks about his sexuality and overtly gay ideas. Whitman is democratic and looks for universal truth. Dickinson is individualistic. Dickinson lives within this Puritan Unitarian community, not necessarily influenced by Puritan tradition, because we said that her family was Unitarian, but the Unitarians did share the community with Puritans, and they shared many of their principles. Whitman openly embraced transcendentalism and found in Emerson one of his biggest sources of influence. Whitman looks for the an open form, the free verse. Dickinson has very compressed prose poems that sound as an inn, that have a single stanza or very short 8-line poems. We see very short poems that we can read in a very brief type of period of time. Whitman's poems are expansive. I don't know if you remember the other day, Song of Myself, it was more than an hour 58 with the recording. It was very long. Whereas Dickinson's poetry is compressed and short and just as a passing thought. If we could think of weather as a way of comparing both, Dickinson is like a passing cloud, and Whitman is like the long, endless summer that seems to be installed forever in our lives. Whitman tends towards expansive poetry, Dickinson towards compressed forms. Whitman searches for an epic voice. Dickinson looks for a song-like, hymn-like lyrical style. Whitman is accessible for everyone. Dickinson wasn't even accessible for her family. Whitman's stance is highly political. He takes a stance against inequality in life, against the misery in life, against judging other people. In the case of Dickinson, it's very psychological. From the point of view of Dickinson's obsession with death, it's morbid in a certain way, and it treats death as something that is unusually beautiful and something to think about in an alluring way. And in the case of Whitman, it's life-affirming, but it also removes a lot of the drama from death. Whitman tries to be relaxed and inviting to his readers. Dickinson's writing sometimes seems frenetic, like if we're in a rush to do something and forbidding. Okay, so let's read some of the poems of Dickinson. I don't know if it's, if I can move this around to the other side. Yes, okay. Okay, so you have her poems in the book. This is my letter to the world. It starts on page 383, the comment of this poem. Professor Gibbet says, this brief poem written in the spring of 1863, which is that crazy year where she wrote 300 poems, nonetheless, is often presented as an introduction to all of Dickinson's work, in spite of the fact that it is not among her earliest verse. The habit of starting with these lines originated in the first volume of her poems, 1890, where the editors printed a regularized version of this little piece and turned it into a prelude when they chose to place it on an unnumbered page, just after a table of contents and before the first page of her poems. So the same way as other poets choose to title their poems, whenever you read an Emily Dickinson poem, if you look at the index of her poetry, you will normally read the first line of the poem, because none of them have a title, none of them have a number. You know that, for example, in the case of Walt Whitman, he collected them in volumes inside the Leaves of Grass. He gave them a certain order to be read. He prepared the reader for what he wanted the reader to read, in which order he wanted the reader to read them. Even a long poem like Song of Myself, he divided it into sections, and every section had a specific format and a specific number to refer to them. In the case of Dickinson, editors were confronted with the problem that there was no way of classifying them. Either you numbered them, Or you use the first line of the poem as a way of classifying them, and that's normally the way selected. So this poem is normally known as "This is my letter to the world" because it's the first verse of the poem. Okay. And normally she has a habit of starting poems in a very powerful way. So choosing the first verse of her poems seems to be a good idea, because they're normally they normally draw a resonance to the whole message of the poem. In the case of this poem, it exemplifies how Dickinson adapted the purpose the congressional hymn that she sang in church. She used a traditional hymn meter, which consisted in quatrains of alternating iambic tetrameter and iambic trimeter lines. That is, stanzas of four lines and alternate lines of eight syllables, four metrical feet, and six syllables, three metrical feet. But she interrupted this regularity by occasional changes in the meter, as in line five, which only has seven syllables, and rhyme, as in lines five and seven. So basically what she takes is an inspiration for the structure, and then she does whatever the damn she likes. Because the poem is for herself, she doesn't have to take it to anybody for it to feel. This is my letter to the world that never wrote to me, that simple muse and nature told with tender majesty. Her message is committed, two hands I cannot see. For love of her, sweet countrymen, judge tenderly of me. As you can see, there is a very odd way of using both the this sort of hyphen and the capitalization. You see odd capitalization in places where we normally don't see it. Some capitalization are easy to understand. For example, this her, or this majesty, refer to nature, but sweet. We have the feeling that it refers to countrymen. There is a capitalization there that we simply do not understand. But that's the way it has to be enjoyed. Safe in their alabaster chambers is the next poem that we're going to analyze, and it's interesting because it refers to the alabaster chambers are the mortuary space that that you have inside a family grave. Normally, a family grave had this building-like structure, and the title itself has a contradiction itself, or a paradox. When you're dead, you don't have the need to feel safe, but at the same time, you are never as safe as when you are dead in your alabaster chamber, where you are untouched by the dramas of the world, by the problems of the world. So inside the title, there does seem to be some celebration of death, or death must not be such a bad thing, because you feel safe in your alabaster chamber. So this morbid way of embracing death in a certain way seems to be something that we can extract as an initial conclusion, but at the same time maybe there's more to the message than just that. Maybe it's to compare it to something different. Let's read. Professor Gibert says, the complex textual history of this poem can be partly explained in the context of the epistolary exchange between the writer and her sister-in-law. In one of her letters, Susan praised the first stanza and advised the author to treat it as a complete poem, which she found deeply moving. I always go to the fire and get warm after thinking of it, but I never can again. To Susan's criticism of the second stanza, the poet responded with an entirely new one. As you can see on the board, the version of 1861 has to do with the revision that she did after reading the comments from her sister-in-law. The first version of the poem, dated 1859, was published in Amherst's local newspaper, the Springfield Daily Republican, where it was curiously dated Pelham Hill, June 1861, and the title, The Sleeping, was added. So these were things that the editors did. They added titles, they changed the punctuation, they changed the hyphens. At the end of the day, they received a handwritten poem, and they knew whatever they wanted when they took that to the typeset. And they decided how it was going to be published. It could have been an editorial choice, or maybe it was the printer's choice when he or she was printing the six weeks after its publication, when Dickinson sent her introductory letter to Higginson, the second version of this poem was among the four pieces that she submitted for critical assessment. In the 1819 volume of poems, Todd and Higginson published it as a three-stanza poem, arranging its line in three quatrains. That is, they combined the first stanza with the two versions of the second one. Johnson treated it as a two-stanza poem in two versions, probably because there is no photograph evidence of the poet's wish to blend the three different stanzas. Apart from change in capitalization, the most important remodeling in the first stanza took place when the author replaced the first word of the fourth line, sleep, by lie, thus transferring the focus from the notion of slumber into that of stasis. The substitution was consistent with the contents of each of the two versions of the second stanza. The earlier version focuses on the marked contrast between the somnolence of the dead and the vitality of the birds and the bees. On the other hand, the later version emphasizes how the universe remains in never-ending motion while the dead are motionless in their graves. So here we have two versions of the same poem that start in an identical way or in a very similar way, change towards the end of the first stanza, and then they go in completely different directions. In the first version, the one on the left, we have a poem that talks about the contrast between the rest of the dead and the bustle and the noise and the activity of everything that's alive outside those alabaster chambers, the birds and the bees. On the other side, on the right, there is a contrast of mortality with all the things that are eternal. And mortality and the ephemeral status of people compared to the eternal existence of other things. So let me read both versions. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by morning and untouched by noon, sleep the meek members of resurrection. Rafter of satin. Rafter are like those curtains. And roof of stone. Roof of stone refers to the physical enclosure of the grave. And then it contrasts it with the outside. Light laps the breeze, a very strong alliteration in that light laps. In her castle above them, many times poetry books use this line as an example of alliteration. Light laps the breeze because it is so la 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 la. If you studied phonetics, or if you haven't, when you studied phonetics, there are two types of L's in English, normally in most versions of English. Definitely in British English, but also probably in this Massachusetts English, where L's that tend to be at the beginning of a word are called light L's because they're pronounced outwards, la 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 la. And L's that tend to be in the back of a word tend to be dark, or velarized. They're O, 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 O. You tend to produce them towards the bottom of your mouth. So this brings a lightness to the sound. You're opening your mouth. It means like, I don't know if you catch that feeling, that it's more energetic when an L is at the beginning of a word than when it's at the end of a word. Noon, stone, sap, and resurrection. All those nasals at the end, they don't seem to be placed there by accident. I think the very few things in Emily Dickinson's poems are placed by accident. Maybe she had changing views of her same poems, but because she had such a bustling mind and she was so frenetic and hardworking, she came up with different versions of her same ideas. So just to connect the linguistic part to the literary part, it's a really interesting context. Light laughs the breeze in her castle above them, babbles the bee, again an alliteration, in a stolid ear, pipe and sweet birds in ignorant cadence. Ah, what sagacity perished here. So it talks about the people that died, but how the world seems to not care about all the important and intelligent, famous people that died, rest in graves. The world just goes on. And the second one has that same touch, but from a different focus. Safe in their alabaster chambers, untouched by the morning and untouched by the moon, lie the new members of resurrection, rafter of satin and roof of stone. See that she's only changed the disposition of the line. Wrangle the years in the crescent above them, world scoop their arcs, and firmaments row. The firmaments are the stars. Whenever you see one of those time lapses of a sky, you see that throughout the year, the sky seems to move, the firmament moves over. Well, that's what the firmament row seems to feel, like a diadem. When you look at the Milky Way, you have this feeling that it could be a diadem on top of your head. Diadem drop in doges surrender, soundless as dots on a disk of snow. A disk of snow can be anything. It can be literally a disk of snow. There's no way of interpreting this because the poet doesn't provide an explanation, so you have to come up with your own conclusions of what that disk of snow means. It can be a comparison of something ephemeris compared to something eternal, or not. Or it can be a contrast of the roof of stone and the disk of snow. I'll leave that open to your interpretation. I taste the liquor never brewed. This poem is very admired and was first published anonymously in 1861 under the title of The May Wine. It was published in May, so probably the editor and the publisher had a lot to do with that very weak title and undeserving title that it received. It got, as usual, editorial changes that were used to please the conventional audience. Some lines were altered to create a more exact rhyme, and one line was transformed to make it a metaphor that was easier to understand. For quite a long time, readers interpreted I Taste the Liquor Never Brewed as an innocent nature poem about the intoxicating joy that the author experiences when she is overwhelmed by the beauty of the spring scenery. The air is compared to liquor, and the speaker, like a bird drinking nectar, surpasses butterflies and bees in her capacity to luxuriate in sensuous pleasure. Nature as a source of delight is indeed a theme that recurs in many of Dickinson's poems, and in this sense, this particular one is no exception. What is unique here is a subversive aspect that is revealed when its last stanza is compared with the lines that inspired it. In the Day of Doom, the divine Michael Wigglesworth had depicted the terrifying scene of the second coming of Christ, when the past over rush and to their windows run, viewing this light which shines more bright than does the noonday sun. In Dickinson's poem, it is also the saints who to windows run, though not to contemplate the glory of God, but to see the little tippler leaning against the sun. So as you can see, there are literary references in her work, and in the next paragraph, it goes on to say that she is obviously exposed to the works of Keats and Thoreau, and also to Emerson, and to his is to say the poet that was very inspirational, I remember, for Walt Whitman, and was a source or probably an originating factor to help him embrace poetry as his form of artistic expression. What is original in Dickinson's poem, continues Professor Tudor, and rather unexpected from someone with her upbringing, is how wittingly she plays with the language of alcohol and inebriation to create an extended metaphor suffused with humor. What is interesting here is something that is not explained in this book, but is explained in the Cambridge Introduction to Emily Dickinson, which is that this was a period, maybe you've watched Boardwalk Empire, which is set like 30 or 40 years after Dickinson's death. This was a period where alcohol was considered a deadly sin. So at the same time as it was not illegal, there was a group, I don't remember how the group is called, of women that would not tolerate their husbands drinking alcohol and would refuse to have sex with them if they drank liquor. There are popular pictures from the early 20th century that says lips that touch liquor will not touch ours, that were paraded by women in their first demonstration. So again, she's playing with a concept. She's playing with a concept of alcohol, which is very touchy and very very controversial at the time. So I think it's an added level of interest that applies to the poem in a period where alcohol was in the center of political and social debates. We know that in the United States in the 1920s, the consumption of alcohol was prohibited, and therefore the period, the dry years and the dry laws are the consequence of that controversy that happened, that started in this period, in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s. I taste a liquor never brewed, and she's talking about a liquor that has to do with nature, or if you compare it to the final part, it's not so positive. It's the liquor that she never tasted is the resurrection of Christ in his second coming and the end of the world, the Armageddon, when Christ comes back to save those that are worthy of being saved from the world before it is destroyed. So we don't know exactly how positive this poem can be or not. It's again up to the reader. I taste the liquor never brewed from tankards steeped in pearl. Not all the Frankfurt berries yield such an alcohol. Inebriate there am I and debauchee of dew, reeling through endless summer days from inns of molten blue. When landlords churn the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door, when butterflies renounce the drams, I shall but drink the more. Till seraphs swing their snowy hats, and saints to windows run, to see the little tippler leaning against the sun. Okay, so here, as you can see, there's a lot of underlying messages that we have to interpret in our own manner. We're facing, I think it's the last three poems, particularly my favorite poems by the author, or among my favorite poems by the author. And I love these very powerful lines that open many of her poems. I felt a funeral in my brain. According to Ralph W. Franklin, the poem was written in the summer of 1862, and it has a very significant last stanza that talks about the demise. Without that last stanza, which was initially eliminated, the sense of the poem changes completely. So we can see in Dickinson this tendency to have like a final twist in your poems and change that meaning at the very end. So the poems can go in one direction and suddenly swerve towards a different direction. There is an extended metaphor. An extended metaphor is a metaphor that is that spans throughout the entire poem. The extended metaphor is a funeral, and the funeral occurs in the speaker's brain while experiencing some type of mental delusion, and this mental delusion it creates a disruption in her capacity or in the persona that is experiences the capacity to reason. It seems to be like a moment where the person isn't conscious of what is actually happening around them. In the fifth stanza, Professor Gibert goes on to say, something unexpected happens. The planks suddenly break, and the coffin, instead of being lowered on ropes into the ground, drops down, bumping against the side of the deep grave until it comes to a halt in the darkness of the bottom. The extended metaphor of the funeral illustrates a mental process that is characterized by monotony and repetitiveness, conveyed by the sense of hearing, the step of the mourners, the pallbearers, and the drum and the bell, which is suggested by the claustrophobic environment of the funeral. In this gloomy atmosphere, the mind becomes numb. The last line of the fourth stanza, wrecked, solitary, here, draws a reader's attention to a different setting, that of an alien land where a shipwrecked mariner endures a solitude compared to that of the corpse in the coffin. We don't really have the knowledge whether she's imagining a person that has not actually died and is within the coffin but not dead. That could be one possibility. It is terrifying in itself. It's almost a terror story. Or a metaphorical meaning of funeral meaning something else. But it is a transition from being disconnected to the world to falling into complete darkness in the last stanza. I felt the funeral in my brain and mourners to and fro, kept treading till it seemed that sense was breaking through. Take into consideration that the pronunciation that I use and the one that Emily Dickinson probably used varies, and many of the things that don't rhyme nowadays might have rhymed in their days, such as fro and through. Probably mourners to and fro, or through, breaking through, or that through was read fro. Take into consideration that the current English that we speak may be different to the English of the time. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift the box and creep across my soul. With those same boots of lead again, and space began to call. As all the heavens were a bell, and being but an ear, and I am silent, some strange race, wrecked solitary here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing then. So you really don't know if it's metaphysical or if it's a physical description. It could be a change in a mental state of being affected in rationality and going towards a world of darkness, or it can be something less literal. I heard a fly buzz when I die. I'm going to go ahead and read this one and maybe make a brief comment afterwards. I heard a fly buzz when I died. The stillness in the room was like the stillness in the air between the threads of storm. The eyes around had wrung them dry, and breath were gathering firm from that last onset when the king he witnessed in the room. I willed my keepsake, signed away what portion of me be, assignable, and then it was there interposed a fly. With blue, uncertain, stumbling buzz between the light and me, and then the windows failed, and then I could not see to see. So this person, if it is true that that person is dying, seems to be experiencing a fly coming forward until everything that the person can see is a fly in front, turning into a blurry blue. And when the windows could be the eyes perfectly well, start to fail, she goes from seeing this blue buzz to not being able to see. I could not see to see. That line over there that is so, I don't know, attractive, at the same time, mysterious and unsettling. The third stanza seems to be like she's saying her goodbyes. I will my keepsakes. She's giving away her possessions, signing away everything that is until she is confronted with a fly. And the comparison that everybody dies in the same way. They say, when the king be witness in the room the last time, this isn't the last time that people are going to see me because I'm going to die. Then I'm going to be buried and nobody's ever going to see me again. Like the last time someone sees their king, it's also when they die. It's the last time they're able to witness the king. So, the democracy of death. Everybody is the same in the eyes of death. My life had stood a loaded gun. It's really interesting, this topic, because it has to do with weapons, which doesn't seem to be a very feminine topic, especially from the time. And it's probably one of the most discussed poems that I wrote. Saying that perhaps because it does not lend itself to a single interpretation, it exemplifies her technique of the omitted center. It seems to anticipate these ideas of modernism and postmodernism that don't have a central character and a central purpose. Anything can be the purpose or nothing can be the purpose. This thing that sometimes unsettles modern readers that want something more classical, want to know where the poem is going, where the story is going. Well, what is the meaning of this poem? I want you to give me one unique meaning for this poem. It's really impossible. And in the case of this poem, it's especially complicated because it's open to so much interpretation. According to the feminist poet and literary critic Adrienne Rich, it is a poem about possession by the demon, about the dangers and risk of such possession if you are a woman, about the knowledge that power in a woman can seem destructive, that you cannot live without the demon once it has possessed you. She considered that this a central poem in understanding Dickinson and ourselves and the condition of the woman artist, particularly in the 19th century. We read similar thoughts, for example, by Virginia Woolf. If you have a talent and you want to be an artistic woman, in this time, that completely separates you from the role of a traditional woman in this period, and completely sets you apart as if you were unusable goods for the patriarchic vision of the world at the time. So, from that point of view, we accept Adrienne Rich's view. Emily Dickinson's poem is openly feminist, but it could be interpreted in a completely different line. Feminist critics have been particularly interested in the volcanic image of line 11 because it is associated to the female writer whose linguistic expression erupts out of silence, disrupting the social structure of the male organization. That patriarchal view of the world. This has been analyzed even from a Freudian point of view as being a way of venting aggression and frustration. So as you can see, this can be interpreted in the light of many different ways. My life had stood a loaded gun in corners till a day. The owner passed, identified, and carried me away. So like you would carry away a gun, the person feels carried away. And now we roam in sovereign woods, and now we hunt the doe. The doe is a female of the deer. And every time I speak for him, the mountain straight reply. If the poem is literal, every time a loaded gun fires, the mountains reply with an echo. So that could be an interpretation of that answer. And do I smile such cordial light? The smile can be the flash of a gun. Upon the valley glow, it is as a Vesuvian face had let its pleasure throw. And when at night our good day done, I guard my master's head. It's a gun. It's the master's head. It's right. Guarding it. 'Tis better than the adder's duck, the pillow to have shared. To foe of his, I'm deadly foe. None stir the second time. On whom I lay a yellow eye. A yellow eye can be a flash of a gun. It can be seen as a yellow eye. Or emphatic thumb. The thumb can be the one of the trigger moving back when you're loading the gun. Though I than he may longer live, if it's really a gun, if you take it from a literal point of view, the gun is going to outlive probably its owner. Though I than he may longer live, he longer must than I, for I have but the power to kill without the power to die. So you never know if it's talking about the literality of a gun, which could be, and it's beautiful in its own, or it could have these Freudian or feminist interpretations. As you can see, we've faced a very complex writer that we could talk about for hours, but we do not have them. And I hope that you have enjoyed and found productive, especially the second, for the purposes of your exam, but if you've enjoyed, all the better. From this author, next week we're going to stay within this high mountain of literary excellence, and we're going to head towards realism, starting with Mr. Mark Twain, and in the final stint of our trip through American literature, we're going to deal with the core of American realism in the late 19th century. Mark Twain, Henry James, Kate Chopin, and Stephen Crane. Even though the two last authors don't have such a reputable name, you will notice through reading them that it's a very undeserved status, because both authors are very, very significant from the technical point of view, and they should, over time, achieve a similar status of greatness within the American literary canon because of their literary quality. Thanks a lot for your attention. I hope this sounded okay. I'll tell you later. I'll watch the recording to see if